Hi, my name is Elad Gross. Welcome to the Elad Pod, an online, uncensored town hall program designed to bring our government back to you. Every episode is a recording of our live show with special guests and questions asked by audience members like you. We are joined by Dean Erwin Chemerinsky of UC Berkeley's Law School, one of the world's foremost experts on the United States Constitution and civil rights. We talk about the Supreme Court, our civil liberties, and the state of our Constitution in our 245th year as a country. Dean Chemerinsky, are you there?
I'm here. Nice to talk with you.
Great. Good to see you. Very happy that you were able to make it. For those of you who have not been reading my Facebook posts, I am particularly excited today. Dean Chemerinsky, before he was dean of Berkeley, was actually my professor when I was an undergraduate student at Duke University. And there was a very popular class that was taught there on constitutional law. And I believe it was the last time that you were teaching it. And I sent you an email because I was on the wait list. And I was so upset with myself because I woke up real early to click the button. But everybody did that. And I sent you an email and I said, hey, you know, I've really been wanting to take this class. I want to be a constitutional lawyer at some point. And if there's any way, you know, whatever I can, I'll audit whatever you want. And you said, no, it's okay. I'll just let you in. And I got in with a few other folks. And I was very excited to be there. And I got to reconnect with you when you came and presented at Washington University not too long ago before the virus. And it was great to see you again. And I'm so happy that we were able to do that and get you on today. So thank you so much for coming.
Truly my pleasure.
So I know that there will be questions that we'll have coming in. We've already got folks watching. Great. From Scott County, Cape Girardeau. I'll be over there a little bit later today in Boone County, all over the state so far. So I wanted to ask you, I think a lot of folks, we talk about the U.S. Constitution, we talk about civil rights, and obviously we're talking a lot about that now, and a lot of that is because we've delayed a lot of the progress we probably need to be making in this country. But from your perspective, especially as an educator, when someone asks you, what in the world is constitutional law? Versus all of these other fields, I get this question all the time. What do you tell folks about why what it is and why it's important?
The Constitution creates the institutions of American government. To a large extent, it defines how they operate, and the Constitution is what protects the rights for all of us. The Constitution affects all of us, often in the most important, the most intimate aspects of our lives.
Yeah. When I started doing this and I was really interested in constitutional law, I saw the importance of it. I was one of those kids who was really into U.S. history and learning about it and everything else. But I got a lot of folks who said, no one is a constitutional lawyer. Now I got to prove them wrong because I actually do a lot of practice in that area. And you were one of those folks who encouraged me to do it. But what kind of work, I mean, in addition to being a teacher, what kind of work have you gotten to do in the constitutional law space?
I've been very fortunate that I've had the opportunity to be a lawyer as well as an academic. I practiced for some time after graduating from law school, but I've been a law professor for 40 years now. I started in 1980, so I'll begin my 41st year as a law professor on August 17th. But all of this time, I've been involved in handling appellate cases. I occasionally have argued in the Supreme Court. I argued a civil rights case in the Supreme Court last November, a constitutional law case in the Supreme Court the year before. Most of the arguments that I have are in courts of appeals, primarily in the Federal Court of Appeals on the West Coast, but sometimes in other courts of appeals as well. And I've handled a whole range of constitutional issues. I've done First Amendment issues, I've done religious freedom issues, I've done police excessive force cases, I've handled a couple of death penalty appeals. So the whole range of constitutional issues or ones that I've had the chance to be involved in.
Yeah. Is there, you know, I've gotten to argue primarily here in the Eighth Circuit, which includes Missouri. And, you know, I wonder when you prepare for, especially for some of the lawyers who are watching right now and some of the younger ones who are out there, when you are preparing, you know, for the United States Supreme Court, right? What kind of measures do you take? Like, how do you get ready for a case like that?
I've argued 7 times in the Supreme Court. I've been second chair probably another 7 times. When I'm the lawyer who's arguing, it's very immersive. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm writing the brief, and so that's the key in preparing for the argument as well. But as it comes close to the argument, what I'm constantly trying to think about is what's going to be the thesis for my argument, the main point that I want to get across, and then what are the specific questions that I anticipate from the justices? It's not unlike what I would do to prepare for any argument. I think well with a pen in my hand and paper, so I take legal pads, and on the left side, I write out what I think the question's going to be, and then on the right side, I write out what my answer is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of the weeks, I'm constantly refining that, constantly looking for how to get my answer across more clearly and more succinctly. I try to figure out how can I get my main points out while responding directly to the justice of the judge's questions. For a Supreme Court argument, I've gotten in the habit that I do 3 moot courts. I do them in law schools, and so that the law students have the chance to hear and see what I'm doing. For the argument that I had in November, I did 1 moot court at UC Irvine Law School. I did 1 at Berkeley, and I did 1 at Harvard. There are various programs for moots, but I really like to do it where the students can watch and participate and see the process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, it's certainly much better for the students. I know it's something that we all certainly do appreciate when we get those experiences. Why? I mean, you've gotten, you know, you're very well known for being an excellent educator in this field. Why are you so passionate about education? I mean, even in, you're talking about your preparation for a Supreme Court argument where you could probably have the pick of lawyers and scholars and all these people watching. Why do you, are you so committed to having students who are involved in that process?
I'm going to go back a little bit and then answer the question directly. If you had known me in high school or in college and asked me what I wanted to do when I grew up, I'd say I wanted to be a high school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I took all the courses in college to become a high school teacher. I did my student teaching at Highland Park High School in Illinois. Mm-hmm. I became a certified high school social studies teacher in Illinois, and then decided really at the last possible minute that I wanted to go to law school because I wanted to be a civil rights lawyer, but always had in the back of my mind, maybe someday I'll get to be a law professor, and I obviously got to do that pretty young in my career. And my passion professionally has always been teaching. It's the thing I love doing the most professionally. Even though I'm dean and I don't have to teach, it's not part of my job, and many deans don't teach. I always teach 1 large class each semester, and I've been a dean for 12 years, and I've done that every year that I've been a dean. Maybe my first semester at Berkeley I didn't teach, but other than that, I've taught every semester, including both semesters last year and both semesters this coming year. And so I think the answer to your question of why do I want the students to be at the moot is a chance for them to learn. They can see the things that I do badly, that I'm corrected by the lawyers who play judge and justice. They can also see maybe some things that go well that they might be able to use when they do moot court or appellate arguments.
Right, right. And it's, I mean, it's so important for folks to get that training too, because I mean, you just need to have that opportunity, right? And far too often that's given to somebody who's more senior or whatever, but at least in these situations, you get to have that. And especially in public service, I mean, I know when I jumped into working at the Attorney General's office here in Missouri, and we had so many cases, you just have to go, like you've got to take those. So it's a really good experience. I know, especially for folks who enter that public service area or a nonprofit in a lot of other places, you get to apply that pretty quickly. So
always, and I always, I always have students work with me on the cases, and I bring them to watch the argument. If it's a Supreme Court argument, they come to watch the Supreme Court argument. If it's a Court of Appeals argument, they do that. That's actually how my son met his wife. My wife was my research assistant at Duke Law School, because as you mentioned, you taught at Duke, and I had a Supreme Court case that she had worked on, and so she came to watch the argument. My oldest son was taking some time between college when he went to law school and flew out and watched the argument. We always go to lunch at the same place after a Supreme Court argument. They sat together at the lunch. And then about 6 months later, when he was a law student at Duke, they began dating, and they've now been married 9 years.
Wow.
And when I did the toast of their wedding, I explained how they had met at the Supreme Court. And I said, I lost that case 8-0. I still regard it as my most successful day in court ever.
That's great. I mean, you know, you can still get some victory out of the loss. That's great.
And two wonderful grandchildren are truly the victory of it.
Wonderful. That's great. No, congratulations. That's really wonderful. Speaking about the Supreme Court, I saw a question come in from Reese. So hold on, let me get that on the screen. He's in Kirksville, Missouri. It's a little hard to read on here, and maybe I can get that changed. So I'll read it out. He said, I read The Case Against the Supreme Court, and since publishing that book, how has your thinking evolved on the existence of the institution? Are you less confident or more confident now?
Well, thank you for reading the book. I still believe in the thesis of that book. It's that the Supreme Court has often failed through American history, often at the most important times. I think the Supreme Court has largely failed with regard to issues of race. Not always, but more often than not through American history. I think in times of crisis, the Supreme Court has often failed us. That was the thesis of the book. It was published 6 years ago, and I still believe in that thesis.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think, you know, currently, in looking at I guess our current situation and makeup of, I mean, government, it changes, but even looking at the Supreme Court, the institution itself, and the role of the civil rights attorney now, what do you think are great spaces for folks, maybe newer attorneys, or even attorneys who've been practicing for a while, to look into when they're saying, if they're very passionate about moving civil rights forward, what are specific areas now that you think folks should really be looking at?
First, I think it's important to recognize that civil rights are protected not just through the courts, but through the political process. So it's very important for those who want to do this to run for office, to run for state office, to run for federal office. There's so much that can be done legislatively that can't be done through the courts.
Right.
Second, it's important to look at both federal and state law, federal courts and state courts. It can't be assumed that federal courts are the only protectors of civil rights. State courts can do this as well. Third, in terms of areas, I'm hopeful that we are at a special moment in history with regard to attention to racism and the desire to deal with the legacy of racism in the United States. I hope it'll lead to new laws with regard to civil rights. I hope it'll lead to more litigation. If I had to pick one area, of course, I'm hopeful it's going to lead to a real reform of policing in the United States.
Yeah. I've been talking a bit about this, and certainly under point number one, I mean, I'm running for office right now. But one of the proposals that I put out there, and other states have this already, is that within the state attorney general's office, there is a civil rights division. Within those offices. Do you think that that's something that is beneficial for states that do have it? Do you think that there is activity that state attorneys general should be involved in those spaces?
Absolutely. I think that there needs to be a civil rights division. I think it needs to be able to do both criminal investigation and prosecution, as well as civil suits on behalf of victims of civil rights violations. The reality is that often local district attorneys won't investigate and prosecute police misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
The local district attorneys rely on the police every day as witnesses in their cases and to develop evidence. I made a recommendation in a report 20 years ago to create an office in the California Attorney General Department to investigate and prosecute police misconduct. In terms of civil suits, often victims of civil rights violations can't sue. They don't have the resources to sue. They don't have the wherewithal to sue. But an attorney general's office can bring civil rights suits on behalf of those who have been injured. So I think it's very important. There is in the Department of Justice a civil rights division. It's not doing as much as I wish it would during the Trump administration, but it's essential. And I think there should be that at state attorney general offices as well.
And it sure seems that, you know, even with, you know, a fully funded federal civil rights division, you know, it seems like a lot would be missed out on. I mean, if you have one per state, they're closer to what those issues are. And, you know, you've got a lot of state laws, just like you said, a lot of them in their state constitutions reflect what's in the national one and might even have more protections for folks in there, too. So
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, it's has California, does California have that that unit now? Have they actually adopted your plan from quite some time ago at this point?
Interestingly, the proposal to develop a special prosecutor in the AG's office for police misconduct did not happen, but others, completely apart from my report, have raised it, and it's really getting some traction in California. We'll see what happens, but this is all, of course, just over the last couple of months.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, a lot has changed. You know, I've been pretty involved in a lot of justice reform issues in Missouri, and we actually just had, I mean, just like what you were saying, there's a lot of folks who have their civil rights violated, and oftentimes they are on that side of it because they can't afford the resources to fight back. And, you know, the state government, whether it's, well, we're just going to do this to you because we don't care, or they just know there's not going to be any repercussions for it, so no one's investing the time and the energy to make sure that's not happening. You know, it's really unfortunate to see. But there have been, I mean, just here, there was a report after it was the Ferguson Commission report. And in that, it did say, hey, the attorney general should be involved in independent prosecutions of law enforcement officers, mostly because you want to instill trust in that system. Like, you don't want to keep perpetuating, you know, some kind of delegitimization of what our public institutions are. And certainly that would go for law enforcement investigating themselves. I mean, we have the State Highway Patrol, for example, that can get involved and has been called to some of those situations, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What do you think, you know, qualified immunity? We had a discussion about that with a wonderful professor from Emory that said hello to you as well, Fred Smith. And I wonder what your thoughts are on qualified immunity.
I assume because you've covered it, your audience is familiar with this. But just in case they didn't, let me give a little bit of background, because this is one of those technical areas of law that most people had never heard of, at least until recently. Anytime a federal, state, or local government official is sued for a constitutional violation, they're allowed, and the suit is for money damages, they're allowed to raise a defense of immunity. Some government officials have absolute immunity. That means they can't be sued for money damages at all. Judges for their judicial acts, prosecutors for their prosecutorial acts, legislators for their legislative acts, police officers when they testify as witnesses, and the president for acts taken in office. You can't sue those people for money damages. They have absolute immunity. But all other government officers, when they're sued for money damages, have what's called qualified immunity. The Supreme Court has said this means they can't be held liable unless they violate clearly established law that every reasonable officer should know. It has to be a right established beyond dispute. In case after case, the Supreme Court has said that officers, this includes police officers, who are sued for money damages are protected by qualified immunity. As many, including conservatives, have said, the court has moved qualified immunity to being very close to absolute immunity. Mm-hmm. So the Cato Institute, a conservative group, has taken this position. Judge Don Willett on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, a Trump appointee, has lamented this. William Boddy, a professor at the University of Chicago Law School, is in a recent article called For the Elimination of Qualified Immunity. So I think that qualified immunity makes it far too difficult for those who are injured, including by police misconduct, to recover.
Yeah. Yeah, I tend to agree quite a bit, having seen the doctorate in practice. And, you know, I think it also leads to a lot of inconsistent opinions where, you know, if something is just a little bit different, then one judge says, well, that's good enough for me to say this situation was different from another precedent that we might have already. And it's just unfortunate to kind of see, because, I mean, again, folks who are suing, who don't have as many resources, the government, obviously. Now, qualified immunity isn't just something where, you know, you assert it as a defense. It's something that can shut down an entire case from the very beginning. And it can be appealed very quickly. And so now you have to go through that process. You're on hold for a long time before you come back. And it's an unfortunate way of really delaying justice in a lot of cases, too, because of how it's been implemented.
If I could change one thing to increase police accountability, it would be to create local government liability when there's police misconduct. Mm. Eliminating qualified immunity in police misconduct cases would be a good thing, right. But I think it's less helpful than many believe, because the test for qualified immunity is whether the officer acted unreasonably. The test for Fourth Amendment violations, whether there's excessive force, is whether the officer acted unreasonably. So I don't know that there's going to be that many cases where the officers are protected by qualified immunity, where ultimately they wouldn't prevail with the jury or the judge saying they acted reasonably. But the problem I really see with regard to holding police accountable is that the Supreme Court said that a local government can be held liable only if its own policy violates the Constitution. So Minneapolis is sued for the death of George Floyd, and I expect they would settle such suit. Mm-hmm. But if they didn't, they couldn't be held liable in all likelihood, because it couldn't be shown that the city policy caused his death. And I would want to see Congress change the civil rights law to say that cities should be held liable for the misconduct of police officers.
You know, I guess in my experience, I've seen in a lot of those situations, oftentimes local law enforcement is indemnified by local governments. Have you seen, are there certain places, I guess that might not be universal, have you seen issues around getting liability on those municipalities as a result?
I want to separate two things. Mm-hmm. One is what you point to in terms of when police officers are held liable, there being indemnification. And the other is holding the local government itself liable. Mm-hmm. Joanna Schwartz, a professor at UCLA, has written a series of articles documenting that when police officers are held liable, in the vast majority of instances, they don't pay the judgment. They're indemnified by the government that employs them. And so even if there were no qualified immunity and the officer held liable, the cities would indemnify. The latter concept that I'm talking about is, if a police officer acts unconstitutionally and there's money damages, it should be paid by the city. Mm-hmm. It might be some indemnification, but I think the better way is to make the city directly liable.
Gotcha. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. No, that's great. Thank you. Thank you for explaining that. That's great. All right. We got another question. I might not be able to get them on the screen today just because the text isn't looking too good, but that's okay. This is from Colin. Hi, Colin. Is there a way to prevent partisanship in the justice system? Many judges, district attorneys, and attorneys general, not you a lot, oh, thank you, are decided on their ability to win an election, not their legal expertise. That's a really good point, and especially when you have judicial elections that get very partisan, sometimes you get some interesting results from that. I know Missouri, we have, you know, the Missouri plan for a lot of the judges, which has been used, you know, propped up as a model in a lot of places. There are some folks trying to get rid of that, unfortunately, in Missouri. But have you seen issues with that, too, with partisanship in the justice system as a result of how folks are being selected?
Yeah. I'm very troubled by judicial elections. Mm. We want our judges to decide cases based on their best conclusions. Is the law and the fact? It's inconsistent with that to then say that judges have to run for office and be politicians. I think it's 42 states have some form of judicial elections. I think the Missouri system, the Missouri plan, yeah, is better than many of them. It has judges, after they've been appointed, come up for retention elections rather than partisan elections. Some states, like Texas and Oklahoma, judges just run on the ballot as Democrats and Republicans, mm-hmm, and there's partisan elections. Otto Kao served many years as a justice on the California Supreme Court, and he said, having judicial elections for a judge is like having a crocodile in your bathtub, because you never forget that it's there. There's always a tension between the desire for accountability of judges and the desire for independence. I worry, though, when we make judges politicians, we come down too far on the side of accountability and not enough on the side of independence.
Right, right. No, it's a very good visual to go with that, too. And Missouri, the Missouri plan is one that applies in so many areas, but there are lots of parts of Missouri where folks are running on a ticket.
Let me add, though, I have the great pleasure, and have done so for many years, of speaking to the Missouri appellate justices each year at their conference. Mm-hmm. These are the Missouri Supreme Court justices and the Missouri Court of Appeals judges. Maybe I've been doing this for about 20 years. I did it by Zoom in June. I was in Columbia with them a year ago, and it's usually at the University of Missouri, and it's usually near the last week of June. So I've gotten to interact with them on a yearly basis. You have terrific judges in Missouri, terrific Court of Appeal and Supreme Court justices. Missouri isn't the only state where I get to interact with the judges, but I think that the process has really produced great results in Missouri. And this, apart from partisanship, ideology, I just think they are really conscientious judges. They are really smart judges. The judge is really committed to justice. So I've been tremendously impressed in getting to know the appellate judges in Missouri.
Yeah, no, it's we've got a very good bench, and it's been certainly a pleasure. I've gotten to really litigate so many cases because of my work in the public sector. And even recently, I had a pretty significant transparency law case, our Sunshine Law here in Missouri. And it was one that, had some pretty immediate, it's been litigated for a long time. And we actually did the appellate argument over a Zoom with the Western District Court of Appeals here. It was something similar to it. I'm blanking on the name of it right now. But it's interesting because now in this virtual world, everybody was very polite and very easy to work with. And I've always had a pleasure doing that. But in the virtual world, arguing, I don't know if you've had to do this at all on the appellate level, is so different. I mean, it's almost like you have to have a bit of a different strategy because the pauses are different and when questions come in are very different. Even when we listen to, the Supreme Court live streams now, it seems like it's very different because folks are getting, more lined up when they get to ask their questions. But it's very interesting to see how technology has really changed some of the strategy there. Yeah. We do have a couple more. Hold up. They're coming in.
Sure.
Great. Mike Bessemer, who was also one of your students too, apparently was in the class with me over there at Duke. He says, can you discuss the current state of federalism in the United States compared to other points in history, especially in light of the current pandemic and federal versus state and local responses?
It's important to remember that in the United States, state and local governments have the police power. It's their authority to anything that's not prohibited by the Constitution. That the federal government has limited powers and can act only if the Constitution gives the authority. It's been the case throughout American history that state and local governments have the primary responsibility with regard to stopping the spread of communicable disease. In 1799, Congress passed a law that said that it was states that had the responsibility for quarantining, not the federal government. The federal government has limited authority. The Public Health Act gives the federal government the power to stop the spread of communicable disease from coming into the United States or among the states. This all got a lot of attention in April when President Trump said that he was going to order that businesses be opened in the states and countermand the orders of the governors of the state for business closure and quarantine. President Trump has no such authority, period. State governors have the power under state law to take emergency action, like shelter in place, like business closure. But the president doesn't have the authority to overrule that. There's nothing in the Constitution that gives the president that power. There's no federal statute. As I said, the Public Health Act allows the federal government to take actions to stop the spread of communicable disease. But no one reasonably could think that ordering businesses to open is about stopping the spread of communicable disease. In theory, Congress could pass a law, I think, that would require that businesses be open and preempt what the states want to do, but Congress has not adopted such a law. There's certainly a crucial role for the federal government. We see it with the CDC. We see it with regard to coordinating the development of treatments and vaccines. That doesn't make sense to do each state on its own. Mm-hmm. We see it with regard to making sure that there's adequate protective equipment. That doesn't make sense to do state by state. But when it comes to public health measures to stop the spread of communicable disease, that's really at the state and local level, not the federal level, notwithstanding what President Trump said, which mm-hmm. just was a matter of constitutional law.
Yeah. What do you think about some of these situations now where there's a conflict, especially if your attorney general is now of the same party as the governor, or a mayor or somebody else like we're seeing in Georgia right now, but over requirements to wear masks? And it seems like this is, you know, some separation of powers issues, but folks are, I mean, they're for one reason or another, they're saying one thing or whatever they're doing. But do you have any thoughts about what the results of these things are going to be, these lawsuits that are either being threatened or upcoming now?
I think one of the great tragedies of the year 2020 is the way in which a potentially deadly communicable disease has been politicized. I wish that from the very beginning, President Trump would have said, this is a serious communicable disease, and we're going to devote all the resources we need to stop it. And if he would have come out from the very beginning and said, masks help stop the spread of a communicable disease, I support laws that require wearing masks in public, I'm going to wear a mask in public. Yeah. Inexplicably, we have made a communicable disease a political issue. Inexplicably, we have made the question of wearing a mask in public a political issue. And we see this especially in Georgia, where the mayor of Atlanta has required the wearing of masks there, and the governor of Georgia is suing to stop it. Generally, state law preempts local law, just like federal law preempts state law. In this instance, though, I just can't imagine a court saying that the governor should be able to do something that's so clearly at odds with public health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess we'll all find out soon. Hopefully, you know, I mean, it takes a while to work its way through the court system anyway. Some of these issues, when you challenge the constitutionality of a statute or of an ordinance or whatever it might be, some of those go a little bit faster than others, but you know, we're all hoping for a vaccine one way or another. So
what's interesting is there are dozens of lawsuits challenging things like quarantine, mm-hmm. shelter in place, business closure. There's lawsuits about, you know, whether people can get together for religious worship or protests. Since March, those cases have overwhelmingly come down on the side of the government. And they've stressed the power of the government to take what actions are reasonable to stop the spread of COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a PS here. Hold up, from Mike, who asked that question. He said taking your class also made him want to go to law school and then eventually become a lawyer. And he's a lawyer today. So you're two for two today at the Duke class. This is great. This is wonderful.
It's great. Well, I had phenomenal students at Duke, including the two of you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. That was okay. I mean, I wasn't that great. Roy's got a question. Roy's a good friend. He's talking about prosecuting attorneys, which I think is something that's been coming up a lot more of too. Folks are really looking at the role of the prosecuting attorney in the justice system and how much power prosecutors have. He's here. It's a bit of a long comment, but a lot of them are elected. Many of them are using the percentage of convictions as a measure of their skill, and then obviously for elections after that. And there's not. I guess I wonder when you're looking at the role of the prosecutor, especially within the overall justice system. I know some folks have been talking about conviction review units to make sure that, you know, basically a quality control to make sure that folks who have been convicted were rightfully convicted and the evidence is being looked at again, especially in questionable situations. But are there any maybe reforms that you in particular think are very promising or folks that, especially on the local level, should be looking at?
Sure. Let me start by saying my oldest son is a federal prosecutor. He's an assistant U.S. attorney in the Central District of California. I started as a Justice Department lawyer. There has been a tremendous shift in power in the criminal justice system from judges to prosecutors. Prosecutors' charge is enormously important and largely unreviewable. Let me give you an example. The first case I ever argued in the Supreme Court involved a man who got caught stealing $153 worth of videotapes from Kmart stores in San Bernardino, California. He did it, got caught twice. He might have been charged with one count of petty theft, maximum 6 months in jail, or two counts of petty theft, maximum year in jail. Or he might have been charged with one count of the felony called in California petty theft with a prior, maximum 3 years in prison. Or he might have been charged with two counts of petty theft with a prior, which under the crazy California system would mean 3 years, 8 months in prison. Or he might have been charged under the California three strikes law, since this was third strike, with one count of petty theft with a prior as a third strike. That's 25 years to life in prison. Or he could be charged with two counts under the three strikes law of petty theft with a prior. That's 50 years to life in prison. The local district attorney charged him with two counts under the three strikes law. His sentence was 50 years to life. The Ninth Circuit said that's cruel and unusual punishment for stealing 150,000 videotapes, but the Supreme Court reversed 5-4. It was the prosecutor who made that choice. In California, how that choice is exercised depends tremendously on geography. Prosecutors in places like Kern County, where Bakersfield is, or San Bernardino County, would tend to charge in that way, whereas the district attorney in San Francisco wouldn't use the three strikes law in that way. We also know that when there's discretion in the criminal justice system, race affects how it's used. And so blacks and Latinos were much more likely to be charged to the maximum under this. Well, you do the same thing in the federal system. The way something is charged affects the so-called sentence guideline range. Great shift of power from prosecutors to prosecutors. A prosecutor's role is to do justice. The prosecutor doesn't have to please any client. And an elected prosecutor has the benefit of serving justice. And so I think there's been a trend across the country towards electing more progressive prosecutors. We saw that in Philadelphia. We saw it in San Francisco. It'll be interesting to see what happens in Los Angeles in the November race between George Gascon, who's very progressive, and Jackie Lacey. But I hope that prosecutors will really see their role as doing justice.
Right. Right. It's very much, I think what a lot of folks have kind of lost sight of is their role in a larger system. And, you know, when you really are, you continue to think about, oh, I just need to get this person convicted. I need to, you know, these are my numbers, these are my stats, versus thinking about what does the overall justice system look like. And obviously in America, we have an adversarial system. So part of that is, yes, you're supposed to advocate on your side. But especially now when resources have been so low. I mean, in Missouri, our public defender system, for example, is extremely overloaded. And, you know, you get to that point. I know I was just listening to a couple prosecutors. There was a debate last night in the Kansas City area, but mentioning how they really want a strong public defender system. But we're living in a reality where, unfortunately, in many cases, that's not the situation. And folks are really, you know, having a tough time as a result. We're having a tough time finding justice in those cases as a result, too. You know, cash bail, the bond system, that's been one that's come up quite a bit. And I know different localities that have dealt with it differently. Here, I actually served as a special public defender for the state, and I represented an 18-year-old girl who had cooperated with police after seeing a fight, but was charged with a felony, probably as some kind of leverage point or something else, but she didn't have money to pay $400 to get out of jail, so she lost 7 months of her life there, including 15 days where charges had already been dismissed, but nobody had let her out. And so we brought some significant civil rights litigation in the St. Louis area. But, you know, I wonder what – I know some folks are saying, well, you know, we don't want to let everybody out. We've got, you know, some folks who are dangerous here. We're trying to do more assessments in determining that. I know D.C.'s got their own system as well. You know, what are your thoughts about alternatives to that system that can be effective?
California passed a law a little over a year ago, SB 10, to eliminate money bail. I supported that. Unfortunately, there's an initiative on the ballot in November that was put there by the bail bonds industry to try to get money bail restored. Other states, such as Kentucky and Massachusetts, have eliminated money bail. Obviously, it is not to release everyone who's arrested. There are dangerous people who need to be locked up from the time that they're arrested. Pretrial detention like that is constitutional, but it shouldn't be based on the ability to pay. Whether somebody remains, as in your client's case, in custody for 7 months or is free shouldn't depend on that person's wealth.
Right. And that's pretty much the bottom line in all those situations. And unfortunately, there's so much of this money coming into politics that you know, you're getting some policies that are bought and paid for, and it's just, you know, it's unfortunate to see. But you know, I think especially when you put some stuff on the ballot, I think folks are you know, we're very skeptical in a lot of ways. But you know, TV is a heck of a thing. But you know, there's less people watching it, maybe more people on Netflix instead. So I don't know. But there's a lot of changes certainly with campaign finance that are probably pretty important around all of these issues too. I wonder, given, you know, I guess talking about campaign finance, in that situation, I mean, a lot of folks have been calling for changes. Obviously we have, quite a few decisions from the Supreme Court that are now allowing a lot of these expenditures, especially independent ones. Do you think that there's any getting around trying to amend the Constitution or just waiting for another Supreme Court before bringing another case to deal with all of this flow of independent money in our system?
I think Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission was a terrible decision. It says that corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money out of the corporate treasury to get candidates elected or defeated. To go back to earlier conversation, I especially worry about this in the context of judicial elections. After all, who's giving money to get judges elected or defeated? The lawyers, the parties who have cases before them. And so I wish there were a way of reforming the campaign finance system in a manner that would get approved by the Supreme Court. But I think that's going to wait until the composition of the Supreme Court changes. I don't think a constitutional amendment is likely to get passed for this. It hasn't in the 10 years since Citizens United. But I think that when the court's composition changes, Citizens United could very well be revisited.
Do you think, you know, I mean, we've had the amendment process succeed in America before. Do you think that that process just isn't really realistic anymore? Do you think that we're, you know, that section of the Constitution now has pretty pretty much gone to the side that certainly the folks who wrote it weren't thinking was going to happen. But do you think it's even feasible now for folks to organize an amendment process to the Constitution?
I think it is, though it's going to have to be something where there's widespread consensus.
Mm-hmm.
And at this moment in time, there's not much in our society with widespread consensus. But since 1791, when the Bill of Rights was adopted, there have only been 17 constitutional amendments.
Right.
Or to put it another way, there have been 27 since the Constitution was adopted, but 10 were adopted all at once early in the history of the Constitution with the Bill of Rights. I think that there'll be other constitutional amendments. Don't forget, of the 17, one was to put in place prohibition and one was to repeal prohibition.
Right.
So now we're down to just 15. The Equal Rights Amendment has now been ratified by 3/4 of the states. Whether it will be added to the Constitution is going to be the subject of is already the subject of litigation. I don't see any constitutional amendment now on the horizon that's likely to get passed. There's ones I would favor. I would want to see the Constitution amendment to eliminate the Electoral College.
Mm.
But the states that benefit from it aren't going to ratify such an amendment, so right. You won't get to 3/4 of the states. I think that those who are in D.C. should be given statehood. I actually think that's true of Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, Guam. They should be able to vote in all elections. It's taxation without representation to say they're American citizens. They have to pay taxes, often even disproportionate taxes, but they don't get to vote. But politically, there's no way that's going to get passed. So I'd like to see term limits for Supreme Court justices, but it would take a constitutional amendment. I don't think it's going to get passed. But never is a long time. I think there'll be other constitutional amendments, but probably not soon.
Yeah. You know, I remember in class, you know, it was the first time I'd ever really thought about it. 'Cause, you know, you grow up and you hear about, you know, all American history and it's taught to you in a certain way. However, you know, where you're in school and, you know, you think of this Constitution as something that's, you know, it's there and it's this super important thing that is dictating so much of what's happening in the country. And I remember you talking about, you know, sometimes you have to consider whether what changes need to be made and even looking at the Constitution itself and saying, is this really the best document for us at our current time? You know, obviously we have made changes to the Constitution. We just talked about that, some in even the major section of the document that's outside of the amendment process. What do you think? I mean, do you think that the Constitution, our current system is serving us the best now? Do you think that, you know, maybe the problems that we're seeing, do you think that it goes even deeper to the point where I don't know if it would be, a convention process or something else. I mean, obviously, if the amendment process isn't going to be realistic now, that probably won't be either. But you know, I just wonder what your thoughts are about this document, especially since there are so many folks who are looking at the system right now. And unfortunately, they just don't have much hope and they've checked out of the system. They don't want to vote. They don't want to participate. What do you think about our current system right now and its sustainability?
Winston Churchill said that democracy is a terrible form of government, but it's just better than anything else that's out there. I think our Constitution is flawed in many regards, but it's better than anything else that's there. I don't think if we set out as a society right now to redraft the Constitution, we would come up with a better document. Let me relate a personal story.
Yeah.
In 1997, I ran for office in Los Angeles to an elected commission to rewrite the Los Angeles City Charter. At least in California, a city charter is like the Constitution for the city. It creates the institutions of city government. It allocates power among them. It can also provide individual rights so long as they're more than the state law or the federal constitution. It can't be less. And Los Angeles has a 15-person city council. One person was to be elected from each of these 15 districts. Amazingly, with a race with 7 people ran for this in my district, I got elected and I got chosen to chair the commission. It was a 2-year process. I learned that there was no consensus about anything.
Mm-hmm.
The mayor had his views. The city council members had their views. The unions had their views. The homeowners had their views. everything in the charter became a compromise. And I think it's a better document than what replaced it. The voters approved it in June of 1999, so it's been in place now for 20 years. And yet, it really taught me that in a society that's as divided as ours, it's a mistake to think we could do a constitutional convention that would be meaningful at this point in time.
Yeah. And I think there are so many. You know, I think the way I look at it is there's a lot of issues within the system. And I think we've talked a lot about selection of folks, and even the people who are commenting have seen some issues there too. But it's not that, you know, I mean, it seems to be something that's really repairable, and it doesn't say like, it's really hard. Like it's really hard to believe that, especially if you've been on the wrong end of it. But, you know, voting is just so important and participating is just so important. And, you know, I think that's something that we've really tried to encourage. I've been trying to encourage for years and years, including in teaching, because civics is one of my favorite subjects to teach. But it's, I just think it's really important for all of us to participate as much as we can. You know, my my campaign manager always says, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And, you know, certainly don't want that situation at all. But I think the more voices that we have and the more outreach that we can do to make sure people are included and protected, you know, the better the system can be. So, yeah. Well, I really appreciate it. This has been absolutely wonderful. Normally, I'm just listening to you, but now I got to ask you some questions too. I mean, I've always been able to, but I just preferred to listen. So, you have done such a and I mean, just from the comments here, but for me personally, you have performed such a wonderful service and continue to do so. I hope you stay safe. I greatly appreciate everything that you've done for education in the field. And thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on, and best wishes for your election.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we're working hard on it. So I really do appreciate it. Thanks for joining us on the Allod Pod. You can participate in future town halls and see all of our past ones at alladgross.live. You can reach me there too, and I'd love to hear your ideas. For now, this is Allod Gross, and I'll see you on the next Allod Pod.